And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John, you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
Thanks for coming in and doing this.
Yeah, of course.
No, I appreciate it, man. Okay. I'm going to start the show with, hold on.
Are we live yet?
Yeah, we always are.
All right.
All right. So I had a whole show planned, and then you sent me like your bona fides here.
Well,
I'm just these.
Can I swear?
Sure, absolutely.
All right.
Fuck yes.
Fuck yeah.
these are the people I know that you've worked with, and I don't know them, but I know ABC Television. Everybody knows that.
Yep.
Adam Sandler, Blind Melon, Celine Dion, Edgar Winter, Jermaine Jackson, Luther Vandross, Mariah Carey, Joe Pesci, Porno for Pyros.
No, Joe Pesci.
Pesh. Oh, okay. Phew. I was like, because I was going to ask about
very
that.
Very talented artist and a very good friend of mine, but not the Pesci.
Richard Marx, Seal, Slash, Stevie Wonder, Tiffany, Toni Braxton, Whitney Houston. Who was the biggest pain in the ass?
Oh, out of those you just mentioned?
Or no, or of the ilk. That's like a third of your client list. They're just the ones that I'm familiar
with. Yeah, this is all early on, too.
Right.
I will preface this by saying all this was at a good majority of it was early on in my career when mm-hmm. you first start out in L.A. and you jump into a role in a studio right out of school. I got a job at a record plant in L.A. and like first day, it was Whitney Houston's in one room.
What?
Cindy Crawford's filming House of Style for MTV in another room. It was ridiculous. It was like I really got a job in the most prolific studio in L.A. And there's five rooms.
Are you from out there or are you from up here?
A little of both.
Okay.
Yeah. We can get into the background later. But, yeah, I've lived half my life in California, half my life here. And so... most pain in the ass. Let me get back to that point. Rodney Dangerfield.
Really?
He was doing some voiceover for some movie.
Right.
And he just came in and he was just, I don't know, obnoxious.
Really?
And creepy.
I heard he did shows like in bathrobes with nothing on underneath.
I'm sure.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, we had a, in record plant, it was meant to be a like 5-star hotel. That
okay.
was the guy that owned it. He had this vision that, and it's got a long history, the plant. But there was client service girls. So, I mean, we had a jacuzzi. We had a pool table. Client service girls that would come take your orders in the room.
Right.
And he was extremely handsy and creepy.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. You meet a lot of these people you meet and you're like, wow, that's just not what I envisioned them to be.
Well, I think that level distorts you. Like I
it has to.
Yeah, yeah. I did I was in corporate turnaround for a long time, and one of the industries I worked in was like high end residential construction, but like real high end, like 14,000 square foot houses and
nice.
Insane. Yeah, insane. But what I noticed is everybody at that rarefied air level was miserable, just miserable, and alone, and a total worldview distorted, and. Yeah. No sense of humor, and it was amazing. I think too much is not good.
Well, I learned early on because I started out as an intern there, And then I worked my way up to night management, answering the phones, so I'd have the whole place to myself at night. But I'd be there for the late night shenanigans, and you'd
meet a lot of these people.
You'd see all the crazy stuff, like Shaq in a hot tub.
Does Shaq fit in a hot tub?
Certain parts.
Fair enough, man.
But you start realizing that these people are out of touch with reality.
Right. Right.
And then they no longer know what the average person cares or thinks about.
Right.
And so that could be taken one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of them deserve it.
Yeah. Who is there a celebrity that you worked with who wasn't that, who just seemed to have their shit still together?
Oh, Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
That man was awesome.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you lost your eyesight.
But
so grounded.
That's amazing. Anybody else?
During that time, it was just there was so much going on.
Right,
like I said, every day there was five different studios in the studio.
Right,
so there'd be five different epic people working on a day to day basis. Some were very grounded, some were very, it was a ridiculous amount of money to record there.
Yeah, I bet.
And I'm just kind of sitting on the sideline, going, "Man, I'm making peanuts."
Right.
And I just want to learn from everyone. I
mean, sure.
That's why you do that.
Right.
When you come up in the business, you like the one thing when I first started getting into recording.
I'm listening. I'm just freezing.
Yeah, no worries. Turn it up. I brought my hoodie, so I'm good. So when I first got in the business, I was a musician first. Went and looked at schools. I sang at Carnegie Hall when I was a kid. I did all that. I had a band, and we were flirting with a record deal and broke up the same day.
Oof.
And this is around the time when I'm 18. And
okay. So you grew
I'm
up
in this area at that time.
Were you born in this area?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm a Navy brat.
Oh, okay.
My father's a naval aviator, or was.
Right.
I moved all over the place. I was in California, Florida, Texas, New York. My family's based here.
Okay.
So I ended up here in high school and had a band back then. God, the music scene was awesome. This is like late 80s, early 90s. Every night, everyone was out. Everyone's passing out flyers to the next group. We were out every single night.
Wow.
So anyway,
drinking age was 18 then too, right?
No,
no,
no, I'm not that old.
I am.
I
went to high school in Rhinebeck.
All right.
And this was back when like everybody my age was born in 63. So, but it was like a paper license and you could you could just scrape the side of the three off and make it 61.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. We did that all the time. It was horrible.
I bought beer with the Beer Drinkers of America, a card that came in the mail.
Well, you're certified.
Exactly. Like, come on, why would they give me this if I'm not old enough? But back then it was different, man. You could drive around and go crazy. Anyway, yeah. I do it every night, and I'm going way off subject here.
That's all right.
So anyway, the start, had a band, did really well, got just shut down. I mean, we were doing really well, and just one day, oh, sorry. So I cut all my hair off. I had hair down on my knees, and cut it all off. Went to Penn State for a year.
Okay, fair enough.
So I'm gonna do music law.
Oh, all right.
And
what happened with the band? Why did the band break up?
We had differing opinions on where the band should go.
Okay,
it was like the right at the cusp of. Excuse me.
No, no worries.
Right at the cusp of the music business was all changing there, late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Everything went towards grunge, and I was like, I want to get grittier, dirtier.
Mm-hmm.
And I had Joe Pesci. No, Joe Pesci. He was in my band too, and he was very much into the pop, and I love that stuff still.
Mm.
And him and I share a lot of the same loves. I just didn't want to do that personally,
right?
So we just kind of split ideas.
Okay,
we were young, you know.
Yep.
So I run out to I said
go to Penn.
Penn State,
right?
Spent a year there.
You must be a good student.
No,
Penn State's not easy to get into.
It's not, but I also I picked some really hard courses.
Fair enough.
Excuse me, I'm just getting over whatever's going around.
No, no worries.
So I spent a year there, and I was miserable. I wasn't doing anything musically. I loved Penn State. Penn State was awesome. It was a great experience. But my buddy Joe Pesch, he moved out to L.A., went to Musicians Institute for vocals. And he said, they have a good recording program here. I'm like, oh, that's fascinating. So we had done a demo way back when. Millbrook Sound Studios, Paul Orfino, shout out, the greatest engineer that taught me so much. Out in Millbrook, we had done a demo, and he just made us sound so good. I mean, do we sound that good?
Yeah.
And how's he doing that? I just loved all the gear in the studio and everything he was doing. I'm like, this is kind of fascinating. So I thought to myself, well, if I'm not – now, I've never fancied myself the best musician, the best singer, the best songwriter, but I know people that are.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not the best, I'm not going to try to do that. How can I still make money and hang out with these people? And that fascinated me, and I loved the whole recording process. So he told me there was a recording program starting up, and this is early on before they were accredited or anything. And there was two spots I could go. I could go down to Full Sail in Florida, and I went and checked that out. And L.A., Musicians Institute, he was already there. They got a program. It's only 6 months. Teaches you, but it was great because it taught me all the basics, you know, all the stuff that they don't teach anymore. You can't learn this. We can get into a whole hour-long conversation on the depth of the audio industry and what engineers and producers think they know these days.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyway, they teach you the signal flow. Like, the mic is here. The cable goes there. It goes to a microphone preamp. You do this with the microphone preamp. This is what makes this great. Then you go to a compressor. What does the compressor do? I don't know. You pull up a plug and it works. That's what everyone thinks nowadays. You got a computer to do it all. Everything was analog back then. So you're splicing tape. You're going on analog. You play it right the first time or it's never done.
Wow. But that's the way you look. That's the best way to learn it, though, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the old way of doing the path in the record industry.
Right.
You get your schooling with basic stuff, then you just go be a intern. The lowliest man on the totem pole. You'd make coffee. You'd go pick up food. You'd do whatever the artist needed, and you'd eventually make your way into the room and start patching cables and seeing other people that were the best in the business doing what you want to do. So you'd learn their techniques. You'd learn what is he doing to get that sound. Like Mariah Carey's in there killing it. What microphone is he using?
Right.
What channel is he running through? What's their path? So I'd start off days where even before I got to be assistant engineer, I'd run in and set up the whole room. So you'd basically recall. I mean, before digital, you had to patch everything back in, you know, cable, analog, put the tapes on, align the tape machine. You're learning by that, and you don't know it then. You're like, I could be doing this. I'm awesome. I'm just at school. I know everything.
Right.
But you're learning the process of what it takes to make every single step of that work.
Okay.
On top of learning etiquette to deal with an artist and talk to an artist and how to handle that ego, because I don't care if you're, you know, Michael Jackson or Joe Schmo, you have an ego about your music.
Right.
I mean, it's a touchy thing. It's your personal creation.
Right.
And we're trying to tell you how to do it.
On the one hand, yeah, but on the other hand, like whenever I've recorded, I rely like super heavy on a producer because
bless your soul,
because I can't hear what I'm doing. Like I know, like in my own head, I don't sound like what I sound like. So, you know, I'm probably the last person that I should rely on. Like I can hear my guitar, but I can't hear. You know, you don't hear your own voice. You hear what's rattling around in your head. So I think that's vital, but I also like I produced this show, and you're right, it's so easy to not with compressor because I use compression, and they even send you like factory presets, so you don't have to I don't even have to understand what I just do effects compressor Smash Mouth LVK or something, put it on the whole
level
show.
Level maximizers.
Yeah, yeah, and all of a sudden everybody sounds better.
Oh, don't get me started on the level war.
Well, I do. How do you mean?
With everyone trying to make everything as loud as possible these days.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Taking all dynamics out of music.
Yes. I agree with you 100% on that.
We're all completely spoiled.
You now, if you use dynamics at all, you're like a masterclass compared to, because you're right, everybody's 10.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Funny thing was, when I went to a recording school, it was the second class I'd ever done. And I went there basically because they had a solid-state Logic console, which is the industry standard at the time. There was Neve and SSL and a few other brands. But basically, I wanted to learn on the best so I'd be able to go work on whatever any studio had. And there was a guy I went to school with. His name is Stephen Marsh. He is now the man in mastering.
Mm.
Thank goodness for him, because everything I do, I give to him, and I'm blessed to get the friend amount of respect from him, because he's doing everything. And I'm like, man, I should have gone into that business.
Still could.
I guess, but my ears are shot now. I can't.
I was going to ask about that. Like, you're probably at the height of it. You're probably in headphones 12 hours a day.
No. I do headphones as little as possible.
Really? Yeah. But when you're in a studio?
Well, it depends on the studio you're working in. Currently, my studio's in my house.
Right.
Because that's what all of us have done.
Right.
We can't afford commercial spaces. Nothing's paying anymore.
Right.
That's a whole nother conversation there. The state of the music business. At the moment, I have my console in the same room where I record it, so I only keep the headphones on when I'm actually doing something quiet and recording.
Okay.
So I can hear what's going on. But normally, you're sectioned off, so I've built 5 studios.
Okay.
And out of 4 of them, I wasn't in the same room.
Right.
So you don't need the headphones. I'm barely ever wearing headphones.
Okay.
It's those late hours of long-term listening where after 6 hours, you can't hear the clarity, so you turn it up.
Mm.
After 8 hours, you turn it really up.
Right.
And then,
By
that 7,000th time, listen to that song, you're at 11.
Is it hard to produce stuff you don't like?
Good question. Absolutely.
It is, right?
Yeah.
Because I would imagine in part because you just don't like it, and in part because it's hard to know what to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, you know what needs to be done. You just can't get it done.
Oh, okay. Right.
There's only so much you can do something, and there's a lot of tools out there, and I hate them all. Everyone that entitles a musician to sound better than their own ability, I'm just straight up against.
Mm. So when you produce it, you try to get it as close to what you're hearing as possible.
I no longer have the burden of working on anything that I don't like.
Oh, nice. Okay. All right. So then I can't come over, is what you're saying.
I'm at the point where I'm just purely selective. And if I'm not, you know, it's no longer a business.
Okay.
It hasn't been for a very long time. The business died 20 years ago.
Was that good for music or bad for music that the business died?
Bad. Absolutely bad.
I'm going to steel man the other side, and then you tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay.
The more musicians having more access to being able to record themselves and on, not on the same level, but improve, right? So I'm starting out. I can get a laptop. I can get a deep, whatever the box is, DA, whatever that is. I can mic my guitar or put a line in my guitar and I can sing and I can hear what I'm doing wrong and I can kind of train myself a little bit that way. I can also, now I'm to the point where I can also like cut demos for no good reason because nobody listens to a demo anymore, but I could do it and trick myself into thinking that there's a path there. But I think and I can do it at a way less cost than it would be to go to Mike Ritz, who worked with Celine Dion, and pay studio time for that. As a matter of fact, it's probably prohibitive for me coming up. So I use the same argument that I use for open mics. I don't really like the concept of an open mic because I think it's free entertainment and that should that should not be the case. But I understand it's the only place to get better because you're not going to get hired until you get good and you're not going to get good until you practice in front of people and it's the only place to do it. So it's love-hate. I would make the same argument with, like, you know, Adobe or whatever. On the one hand, I understand that it puts a ceiling on the amount of quality because there's a musician and there's a producer and you can be, I don't know if you can be great at both, but I have access to stuff that I couldn't afford. I can at least get to a B+ that way.
So, good question. There are people that are able to do it.
Okay.
I think having the tools and the availability and affordability of the tools nowadays is a great thing for the right people.
Right.
And I think as long as you use that as, say, a demo process,
mm-hmm.
then, I mean, that's just the same thing I was doing. You know, when I'd stick I record into a boombox and then stick another boombox next to it, play it back.
And play over it.
And play just over it.
Just keep doing tracks.
Know?
Yep, been there.
Or I'd borrow the 4-track cassette recorder from the AV club at school.
Right.
You know, you it's okay. That's exactly what you need to get stuff down, get your ideas down, work on your craft, learn how to layer. All that's a great benefit these days.
Right.
You got free programs that'll give you 10 times more than I ever had.
Sure.
And I think that part of it is fantastic.
Okay.
There's some people that are doing it. I mean, great example, Billie Eilish. Now, granted, her and her brother are extremely talented.
Right.
They did it in a bedroom.
Yeah, that's cool.
But they had the skills and the know-how to do it. And they're just really talented.
Yeah.
That's not your average Joe Schmo.
Right.
It's great for demoing.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to do it right, you may be able to get away with that.
Mm-hmm.
Today, sonic quality means nothing to the average listener.
Well, true, but that's because of the delivery mechanism, right? Like, I load the show up to Spotify, right?
Yep.
Won't take a WAV file. I know a WAV file sounds better. Too big. Won't take it. So right. all you can listen to is an MP3 of the show. So already we're suffering. Now, you know, people are listening to it in a car through car speed, through Bluetooth from their phone.
So the car is probably the best thing they're listening to it in.
Yeah. And
hopefully.
Right. Because that's at least an enclosed environment. Or they're listening to it in shitty headphones or their earbuds. And so I don't blame musicians for that because it almost doesn't – it's like why put all that effort into the top levels of sound when the delivery mechanism is just going to knock it out anyway?
Well, I feel that there's a big market now. I'm so glad vinyl's coming back.
Yeah.
That is huge.
Yeah.
Some of my greatest listening experiences have always been vinyl,
mm-hmm.
Analog, anything. I even miss cassettes because they had a certain something.
Yeah, yep.
CDs were
the beginning of the end,
but horrible.
Mm.
After that, we haven't had anything good. I mean, it all just went, and that's a lot of what killed the music business back. Why I closed my studio in California in 2004.
Now you had your own.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I went, a little backstory, I went from working in the big studios, finally started working up in the room, assisting. A lot of those sessions I worked on, I was an assistant.
Right.
I wasn't actually the engineer, but I started engineering those sessions, going around town, jumping from studio to studio. And then eventually I just decided that I didn't like working on the A-list artists, and I didn't want to go down that path.
Mm.
Because that's what a lot of people in L.A. do. That they'll jump, they'll latch on to an engineer and a certain path, and then they'll be that protege, and they'll start doing all the B mixes for that person. Excuse me. And you eventually take over their work.
Explain what a B mix is.
Okay, so you'll start doing every time you do a mix, you'll do about 6 or 7 of them.
Okay.
And then so the engineer will come in and set all the levels. And you have to run all the other mixes, like the vocal down to dB, vocal up to dB. So you got yourself covered because you're in that studio. It's not your studio. You're paying for time. So you get it right where you think it should be. And then you make B mixes of everything else so that you make sure that no matter what, you're covered.
You're leaving with something you can work with.
Because the A&R guy might say, like, oh, we really want more guitar on that. Okay, here's a guitar up,
right.
up mix.
Oh, okay, I see what you're
mix.
Saying.
Here's the instrumental mix.
Right.
Here's the TV mix. And right. you start doing those. The next thing you know, you're getting their clients that they can't handle. And you just start, you get the reputation of you've worked under this person. And I had that chance. And I decided at one point that an opportunity arose where in Venice Beach I had a couple friends who wanted to invest in this studio in Venice Beach, and one of the guys I knew, one of the techs from Record Plant had built this place. It was an old racquetball court building in Venice Beach, and he had built this like Parthenon-like control room.
Oh, cool.
It was actually, I swear some Hollywood prop guy worked on it, because literally you walked in this Parthenon, that was the control room, and it had a ceiling with a stars.
Oh, wow.
Like uplit on it, and it was vibey as all get out.
Right.
And then you go to the back, and it was an old racquetball court, so it sounded fantastic. It had a loft over it. And we put an analog tape machine in that place and started recording a bunch there. Had a bunch of parties. Like, we'd have parties, and like everyone from the scene would come over, and once a month we just kind of showcase the studio. And, like, all these crazy people come by. Perry Farrell's, like, down the street. I got to go. We'd go back and forth to each other's studios and have parties because that's just
right.
That's what it is. Where was I going with all this?
We were talking about how you came to have your own studio.
Okay. So that was my first one.
Right.
I fell out with those guys because I was just doing nothing but work. And so I finally built one in San Pedro.
Okay.
Right across the, basically, San Pedro and Long Beach kind of corner the shipping industry.
Okay.
And Port of L.A. And I finally got an investor, and I built the most beautiful studio. It was the first one that was, like, really mine.
Yours, yeah.
Excuse me. Sorry.
No problem.
Anyway, that was – all right. So we were part of a scene. That was great. Because I decided I didn't want to work with the big people. I liked working with bands in their infancy state.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what my niche was. I loved getting a band that was just like, okay, we're undiscovered. We have this sound. That excited me, you know, being in the ground level.
Mm-hmm.
The big stars, they already know what they're doing.
I was going to say, I bet you can have more impact.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm actually like, I have some impact. I wanted to produce more.
Right.
I was engineering a lot, and I was letting my creative juices just fall away. So by having this studio, it was a Karma Recording Studio in San Pedro. And for 5 years, the Long Beach music scene was just booming. I mean, Long Beach is home to Snoop, So many artists come out of Long Beach. Anyway, there was this place across down in Long Beach. It was an old warehouse.
Okay.
And they'd have shows probably once a month. And there was four stages inside this warehouse. And musicians would also live there. And they'd just constantly you'd be rotating four stages of artists.
Wow.
They throw these big old parties, and you'd get acoustic artists on one stage. The next thing you know, you got a rock artist on the other stage. And it was just fantastic. And I just kept pulling artists out. I'm like, hey, come. I'll give you a free day at my studio. Just come in. Let's try it. And I started plucking my own artists. And it was great because I put out a compilation of them all, and I said, I'll give you free advertising. Next thing you know, they're all like, yo, you got to go check out the Carb Studio. It sounds great. This, that. 5 years on top of the world.
Fantastic.
Business was great back then.
Fantastic.
And then around 9/11.
Oh.
And Napster.
Yeah.
9/11. And the business just crumbled. Like, just dropped. No budgets. Nothing. So people weren't spending money anymore.
And you attribute that mostly to Napster? Or
people stopped paying for music.
Right.
People stopped buying. When's the last time you bought an album?
Yeah, for a while. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I could ask most people that question. They'd be like,
they can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bought three this year. That's nothing.
Right. That's three more than I bought.
Right. And it's all vinyl.
Yeah. Well, and it's so funny because sometimes like bands or artists will come in here and they'll give me a CD. And I'm like, I don't even think I have anything that plays it anymore.
I do in my garage.
Yeah.
And I have a recording studio. And
right.
I actually could play it, but
still. I have an old car I could play it in, so I could do that. But like in the house, the laptops don't take them anymore, and I don't even know what a CD player looks like anymore. So there's one over there actually. Yeah. Take that back.
I hear they're starting to put stuff back out on cassette now.
Oh yeah,
it's niche-y, but
yeah, so people stop paying for music,
right?
And so then people stop having a budget to produce music.
Yeah.
So the only thing they really can do is turn inward and say, okay, well, I got a laptop. Let me just fucking figure this out.
Everyone started being able to do it at home.
Right.
The computer revolution had taken over. Everything went digital.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounded pretty bad for a while.
So 2005 is like 20 years ago. What have you been doing for the last 20 years?
I moved back here.
Right.
In 2005. And I went straight to my friend Paul in Millbrook. At Millbrook Sound Studio, and he was still holding on. And I did an album for Anthrax.
Sure.
I did an album for Frank Carrillo, who's a local guy, but played with everybody. I was doing really well. I had about 6 months worth of work out of a year.
Okay.
It was still holding on. I mean, he had a great analog studio, and he needed someone that could run Pro Tools. I got in on Pro Tools on day one, and I was good at it. Not a whole lot of people were back then. Did that for a little while, and then had to get a day job, man. I've been.
What'd that do to you?
It's a little bit of pride lost, but I still do it.
Right.
I've actually built two studios out here.
Oh, okay.
At one point, I had one in Poughkeepsie. Built it all out, put a big old console in, an analog console, and had that run for about a year. And apparently it was above Sarcho's. You know where?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Okay, yeah, it was like a big rehearsal space, lots of bands. We had a control room, a beautiful tracking room.
That sounds like it would work.
It was working for about a year. I was like, I might actually have another run at this.
Yeah.
And we got evicted due to the landlord not paying his property taxes. So that just kind of shut all that down. I know.
Do you ever have a vision of doing that? Because that space, that sounds like it would.
If I had that space again,
yeah,
at the right price, I'd do it.
Yeah. Or a space like that. Because the idea of recording or practice space, there's nothing.
Well, I was just talking to Jason Gitzer about this a couple weeks ago.
So was I.
And he's like, Michael, get your studio stuff, because it's all in my house now. I got this
right.
epic house set up. But you don't want to have, like, too many people
not
in
jobs
your
in
personal
your
house.
House. Yeah, yeah, sure.
So I do it for fun now.
And okay.
I've mixed a lot of records in it. I do a lot of that. A lot of singer-songwriter stuff. Just
how
nothing.
You doing?
How you doing? Yeah, so I got a great space in my house.
Mm.
And I love working in it, but it's also in my house. So it's like
right.
the work-life disconnect is a little bit
right.
funny. You
right.
might have a dog bark in the middle of your vocal take.
Right. Which for me would add, but for
exactly.
I can see where other people it would be yeah. a problem.
I'm all right with that.
Do you record yourself anymore?
I never record myself.
No?
No.
Oh, if I could do what you would do, it'd be all I would do. Except I don't like the sound of myself, but...
Yeah, I can't stand the sound of myself either.
So I do this lifted project thing, right?
Yep.
So I have to cut a demo for it. So last year was the first year we did it. And so I'm friends with Eric Dalton, so I went to him and said, hey, you know, let me use the studio and cut a demo. And that's a choir song, right? So there's you know, there's different parts involved, so I'm recording them. But to make the effect of a choir, Eric says, listen, sing the same line 12 times. And I'm just going to layer it on top. So it sounds like creates a choir
it's
effect.
Like 12 of you.
Yeah. If you don't like the sound of your own voice, and then there's a choir of you.
It's just magnified by 12.
It's a root canal. It's yeah. it's not good. But
it's a tough process. My biggest problem is I've spent my life. I'm brutally honest with my artists.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I really went from just engineering to they all wanted to know what I thought because I'm trained. I've started as a musician. I know what you're doing. I know how to tell you what to do. I know when you're not doing it well enough, and I'll get the best out of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's my job.
Right.
Is to make you sound better than you think you can.
Right.
So, I had a point.
So you're brutally honest with your artists.
Yeah, so anyway, you have to be able to let them know. And for myself, I'm honest enough with myself to know that I know 12 people who can sing it better.
So talk to me about the better and best thing, because I have lost friends over this.
Okay.
So my argument is, I got in like a little Facebook thing. It was stupid. So a guy came in here and went and we had just done the lifted project. And you know Sean McKenna?
Yes.
Okay. So
we were in my first band with ever was.
Oh,
Sean
really?
McKenna.
So he had just done the lifted project and he worked his ass off on it.
Like, yeah, he's a worker.
Oh, first guy there, last guy there carrying everybody else's equipment and just. You know, just a super wonderful guy. So,
yeah, he helped me move my studio.
Oh, did he?
Speaking of carrying equipment.
Oh, there you go.
He's a good dude.
He's a real good dude. So this one guy writes this post in Facebook and says, hey, this is the best bass player in the Hudson Valley. If you know, he's clearly the best bass player in Hudson Valley. So I'm like, all right. So I'm trying to prop Sean up a little bit. So I don't know about best, but Sean's my favorite, and here's why. And I just was thanking him for everything he did for the Lifted Project. Yeah. It was an innocuous thank you to Sean. I'm not knocking any other bass player. I just thank you, Sean.
I think I remember seeing this post.
Okay, yeah. And then so I got lit up. And the first guy goes, if you don't think my guy is the best bass player, it's because you don't know what you're listening to.
Oh, that's good.
And yeah, I'm like, oh, thanks for that. And so we get into this whole better best thing. And my argument was, I don't know how you have a best. I don't know how you and better's not even quantifiable. Unless the only way I think a producer could make me sound better, and this is where you're going to correct me, is if the producer sits with me first and says, tell me the goal here, and then says, I can get you closer to your goal. That would be my interpretation of better. Am I wrong?
Not at all.
Oh, okay.
Not at all. You could actually... Jason Gitzer has mentioned this back to me a few times because one thing I do with an artist, they come in with songs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say, you come in with a song, he comes in with a song. I may or may not be familiar with that song.
If I come in with it, you're not going to be familiar.
Exactly.
All right.
Maybe I've seen you live and I've heard a song before, but there's a lot of songs, and my brain is absolute chaos when it comes to music. I can't enjoy music. I'm overanalyzing everything. So
is that true?
Yeah.
Your gift is a curse.
I was told on day one of music school that you will never be able to appreciate music correctly ever again. Not correctly, just appreciate
as
it
a,
in the same way.
Right.
Because you're always going to be thinking about, all I think about is layers, textures, the performance. It's a tapestry, and I can't help but overanalyze everything. So let me get back to where I was going with this.
Yeah, please.
As far as getting the most out of an artist, I find that I might not know exactly where they're coming from, and you know, as well as any musician knows, that every song comes from a certain place and a feeling. More than anything, just a feeling and a thought, and it's sparked there.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest thing is for me to get them into that space to where they're as close to that as possible.
Mm.
So, for example, I was working with Jason Gitzer, and we've done an awful lot in my studio, in my house. And I'd say to him,
"That's usually my family."
I know my phone's going off. Anyway, I'd say to him, "Tell me about the song. What does the song mean to you? Where were you at when you wrote it? What was your thought process?" And it takes you and it puts you back in that place. And then if I have to, I'll dim the lights. If I have to, I'll open the curtains. I have full sunlight and a full panorama view of my property from my studio.
Mm.
I can close that off and close you into a little dark space.
Mm.
I'll close all the curtains sometimes. I'll open them up. It all depends. What is that song about? I've recorded people lying on the floor, just singing up. I've recorded people on, like, in a little cradle position.
Mm-hmm.
It's sometimes in an ISO booth, sometimes in a big room. What helps you get in that headspace? Because every single person and every single song is different.
Right.
And how do you best represent that? And that's basically my whole job.
That's beautiful.
I'm less about – I stopped worrying about the technicality of recording a long time mm-hmm. ago, because you do it so many times, you just know I could plug this in 2 seconds and I know it's going to be a great signal chain, basically nothing done to it.
Mm-hmm.
My job is to do the least amount of work possible and have you give me everything.
Right.
That's when the business was at its best. That's when all songs are at the best, when they're the most raw. If you don't feel a song, you're never going to like it.
Could not agree more. How come producer will not let me do this? Every time I go into a studio, I got to play the guitar, make a track, then I got to sing, make another track, and then they put the two together, right? But my argument is...
Do you ever originally play it like that?
No. Right?
Makes no sense.
Thank you. Thank you. No producer will let me do that. And my argument, like, it's funny. I don't have your gift or your curse, but I have a little tiny bit of it. And like, for me to hear an acoustic guitar, that I don't hear like a normal person. I can almost tell the difference between woods and blah blah. So it really, like, it rattles me. Yeah. I'm probably a nut job, but whatever. Acoustic guitar is a percussion instrument. You got to hit it to make sound, and it vibrates, and the way it vibrates will shape the sound. Yep. Your body is also vibrating. That's why when I hold my guitar and play it, it sounds different than when you hold my guitar.
You're also feeling those vibrations,
right?
As you're singing,
exactly. So that changes your voice, and you're vibrating as a guitar. That changes the guitar, and for me, the joy of seeing a singer-songwriter do stuff is watching them do two things at the same time. To me, that's a joy. But producers don't let you do that.
Not all.
Yeah.
But here's where I go back again to the training of I went the old school way, mm-hmm. and no one has that chance to do it anymore.
Mm.
There's no one learning anymore the recording process that has the chance to learn from someone else.
Right.
It's online courses. It's
YouTube.
I laugh at these things when they pop up on my feed. Oh, looking for producers. We will teach you how to produce in 10 easy steps.
Right.
Come on.
Yeah.
That it's all about the psyche of the artist and what that takes. And if you take... I don't know a good analogy for it. If you take an instrument away from someone that's never performed without that instrument, it's never going to sound like it was intended.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's all the play off of the – they're getting softer because they're singing. They're singing louder because they're playing softer or louder. It's an ebb and flow that you
want the balance of both. Yeah, 100%.
If the song was written,
I'm so kicking your door down.
Yeah, it's also
you get
real easy.
Yeah.
It's got to be as primal and as organic as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
I am not. I used to be. Now, many people in the beginning they overcomplicate things. I used to throw 20 mics on the drums. I'd record 40,000 takes and look for the perfect one. I'm more of the mindset. I once heard the original tapes of Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Okay.
There were we did a lot of transfers back then from analog to digital because the tape degrades over time.
Right.
And it was an 8-track tape, analog.
Mm.
And on one channel, you got all the drums.
Okay.
On another channel, you got all the background vocals.
Right.
Every single person was playing in the same room. Every single person had to do their job and rehearse and get it done right the first time.
Right.
And that's what made that magic.
Mm.
That's lost.
And the other thing that's lost is just the market for original music, period.
Yeah.
So we live in the Hudson Valley, and I constantly say this is a bizarre place because there's, like, per capita so many really talented musicians. And there's a lot of them are very good songwriters, and there's a lot of good original stuff. There's no market for it.
No one wants to hear it.
Nobody. I was talking to Gizzer about this too. I'm like 80% of the way to doing this. I want to do like a small venue, like a really small venue, like a coffeehouse venue that only does original music. Because my argument is, you don't like my original music because you only heard it one time. For a song to stick with you, you got to hear it a few times, in order for you to really connect it. So the idea would be, I would give Mike Rich Saturdays from 5:30. I would give Michael Rich Saturdays from 5:30 to 6:30, so that you could go gig afterwards, but you'd have that Saturday every Saturday, so people would stop by and. Are getting their coffee or their wine or whatever at 5:30 on Saturday are going to hear your originals. You do that 2 or 3 times. And honestly, like, I like that song. Let's go see when Michael's playing again. But nobody's building the base for original music anymore.
No, there's not really a whole lot going on right now.
When you were playing around here coming up, was there more original music?
There was about 8 different venues. Every night you could be at any 3.
Mm.
And they had a band playing, and we'd go from one, we'd play one, and then go to another and go hand out flyers or just go mingle or just go see our friends play.
Right.
And everyone was doing originals.
Right.
There was, Extremes, The Chance, Confettis, Birdies, Let's Dance.
Did it when you shut down and moved back here?
Yeah.
Did that depress you?
Subconsciously, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever been depressed?
All the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Like clinically?
I think so.
Do you do anything for it?
I tried self-medicating for a long period of time.
Mm. How'd that go?
Not so well.
Yeah, that story's rough. Yeah,
I struggle with that still. I mean, constantly. Jason and I talk about this all the time, and a lot of his songs are are based on depression, and it's you know, I'm not doing what I feel like I was intended to do, and I can't. I can do it. I just...
You can't make a living out of it.
You got to pay the rent, and right. You got to do everything else. So I spend a lot of my days wondering why I'm, you know, I'm not doing what I love as much as I could be doing. I won an award this year.
Which one?
LA Web Fest award for best soundtrack. I flew out to LA and I got a trophy. And
congratulations.
Yeah, man. I've won a couple of European Grammys.
Fantastic.
A few years ago for mixing stuff. I do work here and there.
Right.
I just can't do it all the time. I was meant to do music.
Right.
Nonstop. I wasn't meant to work a day job.
That is so.
So it's you got to wrestle with that.
What do you think? Well, like,
so I was talking, like we brought up earlier, I was talking to Jason Gitzer, and he says, what we need to do is we need to take the studio, make that one room. We need to find a facility for it, first of all. Have about 6 or 7 rehearsal studios, because mm-hmm. there is nowhere in the Hudson Valley for people to practice right now. Even if you had an original band,
right.
Unless your parents let you use their basement or their living room, which no parent ever wants to do.
Right.
It's brutal.
Right.
It takes time to work that out. I don't want to listen to it either.
And nobody wants to move a drum kit around.
Right.
Nobody wants to, yeah.
So have a rehearsal space. Have the one room for his Soul Mouth Radio, which is great what he's doing with original music, by the way.
Just yep.
That radio station and that and like this podcast are great for showcasing what people are doing. And then have a studio involved and then – God, just make that a hub and then start building around that with a venue as well.
Yep.
And that way you have all the facets. Like you come in, you rehearse a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
I could walk down the hall and go, hey, and I'm a big fan of pre-production. If you ever come to record with me, I expect you to be prepared, and I will tell you this because that's everything. I'm not into wasting your money or my time.
Right.
It goes hand in hand.
Right.
I don't have the patience for you figuring it out in the studio. I don't mm-hmm. want to take your money for you to figure it out in the studio. It's not what I'm about.
Right. So what kind of things are you looking for me to know when I come in?
Okay. So if you're coming in to record, I want you to know exactly what you want to record. We can talk about that ahead of time. Know your parts in and out. Know your... I can help you with arrangement if you'd like, but that's something that we should probably – I do a lot of pre-production. I believe that talking beforehand and being prepared is mm-hmm. everything. So if there is going to be a major change in the song, we're not doing it in the studio.
Right.
I come from studios where they're charging $2,000 a day. I mean, there's no time for that.
Right.
You're prepared when you go in. We get the job done. Otherwise, it's kind of brutal. You get long nights and –
Yeah.
Figure stuff out on the fly, and that's all right. For some sessions, it's kind of cool. But you got to know that going in.
Right. You got to rent a house for a month if you're going to do that and right. have the studio in the house and everybody
yeah,
live there
like
and work stuff out.
I got the studio in my house now. I actually have the ability to do that if I want to.
Right.
And I will do that for certain people. I bring in friends now, and I bring in passion projects.
Mm.
That's all I do.
Okay. Good man.
I get calls all day long, and unfortunately, I got to... You know, say no to many of them because it's in my house.
Right. Yeah.
No, that makes sense. Commercial facility, I'd be working on those all day long.
Right. Gizzard was talking to me about that idea, and he said you should move the podcast down there too. And I'm like, let's chat.
It's a great idea. It's like I was talking about with the space in Long Beach. There's musicians living there. There's 5 stages.
Mm.
They'd throw shows where it would just constantly be rotating stages. And it was like a little festival.
Right.
And it was a melting pot of creativity and musicians and different ideas. And they did have a studio in there. It wasn't the greatest, but it was something for them to demo.
Right.
And so everyone would just hang out there, and it breed creativity and a lot of great stuff because everyone was feeding off each other, like, oh,
sure.
You can do that. I can do this.
Right.
So they're getting better, and they're like, oh, maybe I'm not as good as this person. I'm going to start practicing more.
Right. And get inspired, at least.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, everyone's so cut off these days. Like, yeah. What are you going to do? Text your friend and say, hey, I got the song? And they're like, okay, great.
Right, right. Do you... So, right now you're living in a space where you can't make money with your passion. And I know so many people who are, like, the opposite of it. They're... And this sucks equally, too. Their passion isn't what they're good at. See, you're in a really rough spot because your passion happens to be what you're really, really good at.
Yep.
I know people whose passion isn't what they're good at, and that must twist your soul too because
I've met people that want to be musicians so bad.
They've paid me
to try to help them with that.
Yeah.
It's one of the hardest things ever.
Yeah.
I mean, and you don't want to tell them, no, you can't.
Right.
Because the thing is, you always it's want to tell you. Someone you can do whatever you want.
Right, right.
If you dream it, it can come true. It's just...
Yeah. So what's your personal life like then? Did it take a toll on your personal life?
Yeah. Just me turning into someone different kind of changed a lot of things. Over long term, everyone just changes.
Yeah, I was just about to say, that's why marriage is so fucking hard, because
the person
you say yes to three years from the time you said yes isn't that person anymore.
Yeah, and you end up trying to change that person, and that's the worst thing you can do.
Right.
Because you've lost everything that you got into it for.
Exactly. And yeah. it's martial arts. So you got to go with the change. I got to go with the way you're moving, not...
The person I was broke at first and just working on just pure grit and ambition and youngness.
Right.
I could work around the clock and all I'd ever do was music. And I was... 180 pounds, and it just did nothing but work.
Right.
And but I made some beautiful music, and that was a great period of my life. Mm. And I thought it would last forever. And having to change and take care of bills and the reality of the music business is that we can't all make it. There's just too much saturation right now.
Right.
And in order to make any money in music, you got to tour. Mm-hmm. Or sell merch because you can't make it on an album sales. You're not going to make it on getting played.
Right.
So unfortunately, a lot of great music just goes by the wayside right now. I've worked on some projects that should be huge.
Mm. But and, the path isn't there.
And then you turn on the radio and you hear this absolute garbage.
Mm. Yeah. And
everyone's like, oh, I love this. It's so great.
Right. Do you... Yeah, that I'm imagining what it would be like to have my thing, my passion, not actually be a business and have to. Well, actually, that happened to me with this. I started doing this as like a hobby, and then I went, oh shit, this is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. And it took me.
And you're doing it.
Yeah, now, but it took me like 3 years, to actually make money at it and yeah. have it be a thing. But yeah, I can imagine. You have kids?
I have one grown-up kid.
How grown up is grown up?
26. He's out of the house now. First time in, forever.
Oh, there you go.
I'm at home with two dogs now.
Ooh, that doesn't sound bad.
it takes some getting used to.
Oh, okay, great.
I've never had an empty house before.
Right.
And this year I've gone down to just being the two dogs.
Were the holidays hard?
I live on a good piece of property, and my mother is two doors up.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I have that.
Okay, that's good.
And my brother's up there now. He lives in Connecticut, but he's going through some stuff medically, so he's at my mother's right now. So I got to spend the holidays with them.
Okay.
My brother lived in the house next door, and then he moved to Tennessee but came up later in the holidays.
Right.
So I actually got to see all my brothers and my mother. So it was good.
So you think you're going to do this thing with Gizzer?
I absolutely would love to. Right. The biggest thing is it's going to take some finances.
Right.
And so if we can find some people that will back it up. And
what about grants?
Good option. I know nothing about that stuff. I'm horrible at promoting myself. I'm horrible at financing myself.
All right, I'll promote you. No, because I do think that's a really good idea. Do you still play?
Yeah.
What do you play?
I play guitar and I sing.
Do you write?
I do.
Have you ever released anything you wrote?
Nothing.
Really? How many songs have you written?
A lot. I finished absolutely none of them.
Okay.
I'm never happy.
Is that the producer starts going?
Yeah, I'm too self-deprecating.
Can you hand them off to somebody?
I have.
And?
I've done that once.
And did it work
out?
Actually,
more than once. I've handed off my songs because I believe they're better done for someone else.
Right.
Like I said, there's always someone better. And I don't believe that I'm the best vessel.
Right.
So.
Did you like it when it was done by somebody else?
I did.
Yeah, see, that's cool. Yeah. That's cool.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just give them away because I'm like, yeah, that song's all right. They need a song.
When you write, what comes first, words or music?
Music.
Do you create it? Do you channel it? Is there a muse? Do you?
I'm very rhythm-based, very it just comes from a vibe. However I'm feeling at that moment, my fingers will just make something that fits my mood. And then usually I'm great at coming up with parts.
Okay.
Not always putting other parts to it.
Right. Acoustic or electric?
I always start acoustic.
I'm my man. Which is harder to play, acoustic or electric? And there is a right answer.
Electric is so much easier to play.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I've been vindicated again.
Yeah, your fingers have to do a lot more work with acoustic.
And there's like less there's a lot more margin for error with electric.
Oh, yeah.
You distort everything, and that almost doesn't matter.
You know, anyone can play Metallica.
Yeah.
Not everyone can play like this really intricate acoustic piece with space.
Yeah, that's my argument all the time is I can see a six-year-old shred. Mm-hmm. I can't see. You don't see.
Oh, that's easy.
You don't see too many six-year-olds covering James Taylor because it's harder.
As you get older, the one thing that makes you better as a musician is learning space and when not to play.
Yes. Yes.
When you're younger, you just want to shred and you want to fill every moment of space.
As many fucking notes as I can get in this measure, I'm doing
off
it.
And
it's a sport.
It's almost now I appreciate what isn't played. And
yeah.
I appreciate the silence and the dynamic. Yeah. Dynamics are lost. We talked about that a little bit earlier with the loudness wars and everything else. Dynamics are lost.
Dynamics are lost. Do you think, though, first off, I completely agree with you. And that's why I love acoustic guitar so much is acoustic guitar note ringing starts changing. And,
yes.
And I love, and if you listen close enough to that and you learn to work with that, you can make one guitar sound like four guitars. If you learn four different tunings, if you learn how to let a note go for a second and not
tension.
Yeah. Create tension. Yeah. That's so funny you say that.
You're playing with emotions when you write a song.
Yeah, man.
Your own and the listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And they're never going to know it if you're just constantly, you know, at one tempo, one dynamic, one everything.
Right.
There's a push and pull that mimics the human mind and, say, just as simple as breathing. We all breathe. We're every day it's a constant push and pull of emotions, breathing, all that.
Yeah.
And music is exactly that same way. I don't – when I hear the right music, my hairs will stand up.
Yeah.
And – I cry all the time.
I was just about to say, I cry. Yeah. I almost think it's a disease where if you put the right notes in the right, I can't not.
I bawl like a little baby.
Yeah, me too.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Even movies when you have a good score.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like, imagine that without the music behind it.
No point.
You wouldn't get it. It would be like, wow, what a great performance. But, you put the right score behind it, and all of a sudden it's just like,
movie without a score is a play, man. No, you need a score. Yeah. I'm totally built.
I feel too much.
Totally built the same. Yeah, but that's your hypersensitivity is what makes you a great producer, because you feel things and hear things that other people don't, and you can make it closer to what it's supposed to be because of that.
Yeah.
That's kind of my vibe too with like AI and composition and songs written by AI. And
I've only heard a couple.
And your take was?
It's mind-blowing what they can do.
It is mind-blowing what they can do. But I'm not worried about it. Because I might be wrong, like the tension you were talking about. It's got to be, sometimes it's best, especially like in a live performance, it's best when it's random.
Yeah.
And you're reading, I mean, you're in a band, you know, you're feeling a room, and the room is almost telling you what to do next.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
this may not be a space where you normally pull back, but you're seeing the crowd and all of a sudden you just need to pull it back for a minute.
Right. Just see, I don't know if AI is ever going to be able to read that.
So, yeah, no, AI is great at like ground and pound rock and roll.
Yeah.
Fill the space with a lot of noise.
Right.
Good example, Tigman. He's got that radio show on PDH. He I turned on the radio station the other day and I hear his intro song. And it's full AI. He let me know later on. I'm like, that was hilarious. It's like, yeah, man, AI. It's fantastic. You just, I don't know how it works. You just must plug in a bunch of words and...
Yeah.
Scary. And poof. But scary. Then it'll never replace, you know, the stuff that will really last.
Right. And it can't replace live performance.
Yeah.
So I think we're safe.
Yeah, as long as we get to see some of those sometime soon.
Yeah.
We're really missing the Hudson Valley is really missing the chance.
Do you it's so funny you're talking about space that and crying. So I'm doing this Lifted project thing, and the song I wrote for it,
check that out, by the way. I haven't heard it yet.
You haven't heard it?
No.
Oh my God, I'll send it to you.
All right.
And also the one we're gonna do is I write the first song, right? And I play it for my wife and she's like, that's not good. And I'm like, fuck. But I'm glad she told me that, because then I wrote one that was
good for her, for being honest.
did the job. But when I write a song that's good, it makes me cry so much that I have to play it like 750. I almost have to get a callus.
Damn, your own songs are making you cry. That's good.
Oh yeah. Almost all the time, but I play them so much that I almost get a callus, so that like it doesn't bother me anymore.
Yeah, I mean, imagine playing your own song and you can't even get through it live.
I've done that.
Yeah,
I've done that. I did a so my wife had this head and neck cancer journey.
Yeah,
and I wrote the song about when I first saw her, got her back out in the sun, and I saw her like remember, because she hadn't felt the sun in forever. Saw her remember the sun, so I wrote a song, I Remember the Sun. And first four times I played it, I had to stop. I was going to kill myself, and I wrote a whole one-man show around it, but I never wrote the song about the moment I decided to do it. So finally I'm like, all right, don't be a pussy. You gotta get in there. So I wrote this song about, and I remember exactly what it was. I'm sitting on a rock wall, I'm looking up at the trees, and I'm like, everything's better off without me. I gotta, just it's best I go. And so I, to this day, I built a function into the song where I can create like a long pause just to get my shit together before I have to sing together, because I know exactly when in the song that breaks me. It's I Do Not Care If You Forgive Me. My daughter's name is Gramercy, but I hope G tells her children. And then the next here we go. And then the next line is, I would have loved to know her, known her children. And it's so hard for me to get there, so I build like
good lyrics.
Oh, thanks, man. So I build like a little thing in there that I can just keep playing over and over until I can get my shit back together again.
Good thinking. it's tough.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a great thing to feel that much.
Oh, sure.
And to have that emotion.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about depression. I mean, stuff like that helps let it out.
Yeah.
Being able to talk about music has always been a great form of... release
yeah.
for too much emotion. Because yeah. it starts building up, and every once in a while you just need to let it out.
You ever been on the on-ramp for suicide? I feel like you have.
I thought about it, but yeah. never actually gone close to doing it.
Okay.
I respect the ones around me too much. And I have an ingrown toughness that I think I got from my grandfather, who was able to just like quit smoking in a second. I always think about him and just man up and quit it. Yeah. You know? And
there's something to that. And I know we're not allowed to
think about
it.
We're all allowed to think about it.
Mm.
But I don't know if I could ever go there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think so. I'd pussy out in the end.
Well, if you start feeling yourself in the on-ramp, give me a call, man. I know what it looks like.
Yeah,
I'll get you back off the bridge. It's so funny because you say, man, like we're not supposed to say that anymore, but it fucking works. There's some point where you're like, look, dude, just man up
yep.
and fucking put your boots on the floor and just go. Doesn't matter if you want
up,
to.
Woman up. I mean,
whatever
it's
it is.
It's just a phrase. But
golden retriever up. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
But that actually works. Doesn't matter if you want to. Doesn't matter if you're in a mood to. Doesn't matter if people think you should or shouldn't.
We all get in that space.
Yeah.
It's highly universal. No one ever talks about it. We all get depressed. We all have our moments.
Yeah.
We all feel low at times. We all have our, like, am I contributing anything? Would it be better off without me?
Right.
I've been around a lot of people that are like that. And especially producing music. I mean, most every musician.
Everybody.
not to mention family members.
Sure.
It gets tough, but you find someone to talk to, or maybe you don't want to talk, but you just got to talk to yourself for a second.
Yeah.
Or listen to a piece of music that'll help you get it out, and that usually turns me around.
Yep.
I get involved in someone else's pain for a minute.
Right.
Or I hear someone else's story, I'm like, I'm not alone.
Right, right.
I think that's one of the best parts about music is that it makes you feel, if it's done right, like you're not alone and someone else feels the same way you do.
Totally. And the other thing, the way I frame that is, because I completely agree with you, the way I frame that is I think it's hubris to think that we have a word for every emotion.
Yeah,
we don't. We don't. And even like the words we do have don't explain the shades of it. Like I can be very pissed off. I can be a little pissed off. I can be, I'm fucking pissed off. Or I can be, that pisses me off. Just you know, there's a spectrum. Music, I think, catches that whole spectrum and adds things that we don't have words for.
Yeah.
And so if you fucking play a song for a sadness that I have that I don't have a word for, but you said it in music, I'm yours, man.
I've never thought about saying it that way, you know? Yeah.
But right?
My favorite artists have just a way with words that I never knew to put it that way. Or,
yeah, yeah.
I feel exactly the same way, but I never heard it
right
talked about or sang that way.
Yeah.
Music is the most powerful thing there is.
I'm with you.
The most powerful art.
Yeah, yeah.
You can see a piece of art and it can make you feel a certain way, but have you ever, I mean, how many times do we hear a song and it brings us back to a memory?
Yep.
There's the only other thing that can do that is smell.
Yeah, yeah. But I think music even more so than smell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Smell, it doesn't happen as much.
Right, right. Especially like during COVID when nobody can smell.
I can smell my grandparents' house. I can.
Yeah.
You know, the little sense of growing up, you're like, oh, man, that takes me back.
Yeah.
But a song,
like,
I don't know, say it's a prom song, you know, it's that first dance.
Yeah,
Or where were you when you first heard Guns N' Roses or something
like
that?
Mm-hmm.
How did it make you feel? And you're racing around in your car, you're young, you're dumb, you're full of whatever.
Yes, sir. Beautiful.
You're driving way too damn fast.
I got to get you out of here, but you got to come back.
Yes, of course.
Please.
Next time we'll do this in my studio.
I would love that.
Yeah, we'll do a little music in the.
I would absolutely love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
It's awesome to meet you. I'm sorry we don't have longer today, but
yeah, we can just spend an afternoon. I have the best listening environment you've ever heard.
I would love to come.
Seriously, I could spend all day just jamming with someone and listening to it. Like, you pick a song. Now I'll pick a song.
I'm in. Let me do that, man.
Yeah, I actually want to host some listening parties. I think that'd be cool.
That'd be fun. Yeah.
Yeah, like just have a small group of people and just like listen to something and really appreciate it. Because I used to do that back in the day when we'd get a vinyl record and
yep.
put it on a nice tube stereo yep. and then just listen to it.
That would be cool.
And like, hey, man, I've never heard Jimi Hendrix like that before. Right. You know?
That'd be a great idea, man.
Yeah.
If we do want to hire you, how do we do it?
All right. So I am horrible at self-promotion, like I said. I think I have a website. A friend set one up for me.
Okay.
I don't know if it's even there or not.
All right.
I'm not even going to put that out.
Okay.
I'm on Facebook under Karma Studio East. And my phone number, again, my name is Michael Rich. Karma Studio East, 845-464-9872. Send me a text.
Okay.
Leave me a message. If, yeah.
Well, you clearly know what the fuck you're talking about, so I'm coming.
Man, I'm an old dog with a lot of old tricks.
That's good. It's a good way to be, man. And let's talk later about that gizzard thing, too, see if we can get
that
thing moving.
Yeah, man. That's the bigger picture, yeah.
Beautiful to have met you.
John.
Again, I mean, we met before, but
yes,
to be able to sit down and get to know each other.
Yeah, man.
I appreciate it, man.
This has been fun.
Ah, thanks, man. Thanks for doing it.
Of course.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.